One Sabbath, when he went to eat at the house of one of the leading Pharisees, they were watching him closely. There in front of him was a man whose body was swollen with fluid. In response, Jesus asked the law experts and the Pharisees, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they kept silent. He took the man, healed him, and sent him away. Then he asked them, "If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath, will you not immediately pull it out?" And they had nothing to say. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honour at the table, he told them this parable. "When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honour, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, 'Give this person your seat.' Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, to take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will not say to you, 'Friend, move up to a better place.' Then you will be honoured in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." Then Jesus said to the host, "When you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives or your rich neighbours. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous." When one of those at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is now ready.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, 'I have just bought a field and I must go and see it. Please excuse me.' Another said, 'I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me.' Still, another said, 'I just got married, so I can't come.' The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, 'Go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind and the lame.' 'Sir,' the servant said, 'what you ordered has been done, but there is still room.' Then the master told his servant, 'Go out to the roads and country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who were invited will get a taste of my banquet. If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost, if you have enough money to complete it? If you lay down the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, 'The person began to build and wasn't able to finish.' Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Won't he first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is fit neither for the soil nor for the manure pile. It is thrown out. Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear."
Stand by to get some. When Jocko and Leif were in Iraq and they heard this phrase come over the radio, they knew exactly what was about to happen. Shots were about to be fired. There was going to be explosions. Their life was about to get really hard. And there was a large potential that it was going to hurt a lot. Right? Tonight, we're going to be looking at Luke 14. And we're going to be looking at the whole chapter. We're going to carve through it. In tonight's chapter, where Luke writes, it's a gospel, it's a narrative, and it's written as a story. Sometimes in the Gospels, when we look at the chapters, there can be days or weeks that pass between the different interactions that Jesus has along the way. But in tonight's story, there is a flow that happens from start to finish with two interactions, with two different sets of people, and they all flow together to make one big point that Jesus wants us to understand. And so we're going to carve through the whole thing. Now, if I was writing a commentary or a study Bible, which is something I will never do, but if I was tasked with this, I think at the start of Luke 14, I would put a little asterisk or a little, italics A, that says, stand by to get some. Because shots are about to be fired by Jesus. He's going to be targeting in particular these people's hearts and the treasures, the things that they hold most dear to them. And my warning for you is that tonight, as I read the passage, you might feel shots being fired at you. Because every time I've read through this passage, I have felt convicted by the shots that Jesus is firing at me and a need to respond in the way that I obey him. All right? So that's what we're going to be doing tonight. It's a long passage. We've got a lot to get through. If you've got your Bible open, keep it open because we're going to come in and out of Luke 14 all the way along and let's get into it. At the start, Jesus, he's hanging out with the Pharisees. And this kind of might seem a little bit strange because in Luke 13, he kind of made a fools out of them in public by beating them in a battle of wits in intellect and scriptures. And so why would they invite him around for dinner or a meal? Why would they have him around? If you read if you heard it come through in the passage, they're watching him closely. The Pharisees are trying to find opportunity to accuse Jesus of something. They want to get rid of him, right? The people love Jesus, and the more the people love Jesus, the more the Pharisees hate Jesus, and they want him gone. And so they're looking for opportunities to accuse him of a crime or something that they can just get him out of there. And so last time when they were having this confrontation in Luke 13, it was on the Sabbath and Jesus had healed a person on the Sabbath. And they said, no, you can't do that. You can't come and heal on the Sabbath. That's against the rules. And Jesus has a back and forth with them and they are humiliated. He serves them a nice helping of humble pie. And the same thing is like Groundhog Day here at the start of Luke 14, right? It's the Sabbath. And there is a man who needs to be healed. And Jesus doesn't shy back in case he comes back at them and says, so is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? We've kind of been through this before, but is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And boom, and he does it right in front of them. They cannot match him with their wits of intellect and knowledge of the scriptures. They are silenced. And when they are silenced, stand by to get some, Jesus starts to open fire. Okay? And he really lets them have it. Okay, come with me to verse 7 as he winds up. He told a parable to those who are invited. That's invited to this, into this dinner. He tells a parable to those who are invited when he noticed that they would choose the best places for themselves. When you're invited by someone to a wedding banquet, don't recline in the best place, he says, because a more distinguished person than you may have been invited by your host. The one who invited both of you may come and say to you, give your place to this man. And then in humiliation, you will proceed to take the lowest place. But when you're invited, go and recline at the lowest place so that when the one who invited you comes, he will say to you, friend, move up higher. You will then be honored in the presence of the other guests. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself will be exalted. At a wedding, you go to somewhere fancy. It's really important where you sit, right? When you rock up to a wedding, you don't kind of plonk yourself at the bridal party's table, do you? You don't do that. It's really important where you sit at a wedding. And where people sit at a wedding, it kind of tells us something about them. It tells us their role. It tells us how important they are. And there are certain seats that are sort of in honor or for guests of honor. Jesus sees the Pharisees doing this in their culture. That's kind of not just weddings, it's banquets, it's meals. There's an order in which kind of things work. And Jesus sees that the Pharisees, they always kind of go straight for those places of honor. They love to bask in the place of honor. It's not the first time either that Jesus has hit them up about this. In Luke 11, so a couple of chapters beforehand, he's teaching the Pharisees. He's trying to help them understand. And he says, "Woe to you, Pharisees. You love to sit in the synagogues. You love the front seat in the synagogues and the greetings in the marketplace." Right? They just love to have this attention and status among the people lavished upon them. It's what they live for. Right? And this is where Jesus is aiming at them. The Pharisees, what's the thing? What's the treasure? What are they holding closest to their heart? One of the things is themselves. Their own glory, their own honor, their own status among the people. Right? And they lack the humility that Jesus says that they need to have. They lack the humility that God's people should have. This is where he's hitting them. And they seek to exalt themselves. They use their knowledge. They use their position to benefit them in the here and the now. Right? They're not thinking forward. They're thinking about the here and the now and what is in it for them. And Jesus says, well, no. He goes on to tell them another part of the story and says, you shouldn't focus on the here and the now. You should have a more heavenly gaze. Right? Verses 12 to 14. He also said to the one who invited him, when you give a lunch or a dinner, don't invite your friends, your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbors, because they might invite you back and you would be repaid. On the contrary, when you host a banquet, invite those who are poor, maimed, lame or blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. And Jesus says, you've got it backwards. In this life, if you're going to be living as God's people, you need to be thinking about others, not yourself. You need to be thinking about how you can help others, not yourself. How you can glorify others, not yourself. Right? And that's a message for us as well. In the midst of all this, there's a man and he chimes in this conversation. He kind of speaks to the parable that Jesus has just said. And in verse 15, one of the Pharisees steps up. One of those who reclined at the table with him heard these things. He said to him, "The one who will eat bread in the kingdom of God is blessed." And the first time I read this, I thought, aha, someone's starting to get it. Some of these Pharisees, like, they've been humiliated a bit. Maybe they're starting to learn a bit and get it. Maybe they're just, you know, on the edge of understanding. Because the statement is very true, right? The guy has said a correct statement. However, stand by to get some. Jesus uses it to push the point home further. Right? And he fires even more shots at the Pharisees. Jesus starts by using this idea that the gentleman has used of a banquet, and he starts telling another parable about a banquet that the guy set up. Now, just by the fact that someone can host a banquet, that means like that they're a bit of a big deal. They have the capacity to be able to host a banquet. So there must be someone of significance, right? And they've sent out invites. But something really strange happens with the RSVPs. You see, if Hugh Jackman like invited me to a banquet, like RSVP, like I will be there straight away. I'll be the first person to respond to that, okay? He's kind of this big person in stature for me and he's a cool guy. And so I would respond quickly. But what happens here is when this person of stature says, hey, I'm going to hold a banquet and it's time to come, something strange happens. They've all got excuses. Right? Have a look at verses 18 to 20. What kind of excuses have they got? But without exception, they all began to make excuses. The first one said to him, I've bought a field and I must go and see it. I ask you to excuse me. Oh, I've just bought five yoke of oxen and I'm going to go try them out. I ask you to excuse me. Another said, I just got married and therefore I'm unable to come. Sorry. These guys all have excuses. And with the examples that Jesus uses, he again attacks the stumbling blocks that people have, and in particular the Pharisees, of accepting the invitation to God's banquet, right? It's all a picture. It's a parable. It's an earthly expression of a heavenly thing. And he provides these examples that are stumbling blocks for the people. The first one in verse 18, land. He said, I've just bought a field. Sorry, I'm too busy playing the real estate market. I've got some things to do. Sorry, I'm too busy and I can't come. I've got more important things to do. Verse 19, I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen. I'm going to try them out. What that tells us about this person, 5 yoke of oxen, apparently that's the amount of oxen. I just want to say oxen as many times as I can because you don't say that in life very often. That's the amount of oxen that you would need to look after about 100 acres of land. Right? This guy in verse 19, he is wealthy. Right? He has a lot to look after and he is far too busy to come to the banquet. So I'll 20. I've just got married, and so I can't come. The funny thing about this one is that if we flip back to Deuteronomy, this was a legit reason for people to be excused from going to war. Right? If you just got married, and you know, there's a big war going on, and you know Israel was going to fight someone, Amorite, pick one, the Ites, and you just got married, you'd be excused from going to war if you just got married because, hey, you might actually die over here. And so, you know what, go and enjoy being married for a little bit because when you come back, like you might not go back to your family, right? And that's a legit excuse and it was all fine. But this guy isn't going to war. This guy is going to a party. And this is not Game of Thrones, okay? The chance of this guy dying at the party is very, 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 very low, okay? It's a bit of a lame excuse and it's leaning on the social kind of structures that were set up. But it's not a rad excuse. We're not coming to the party. And so how does the host respond? Well, this banquet is going to happen. Whether these guys who I've invited come or not, the banquet is going to happen. And so he says, fine, go out. Bring in the lame. Bring in the maimed. Bring in the blind. Bring in all the people who would be seen as not worthy. The people who probably shouldn't get invited to a party of high stature. Right? Even in when it gets to verse 23... then the master told the slave, go out, because the house isn't full yet. Go out to the highways and the lanes and make them come in so that my house will be filled. It's got that same vibe that we had last week in Luke 13 when Neil was talking about the people coming from north and south and east and west. There are people coming into this house from everywhere because the people who were invited were too busy and they had too many important things to deal with to come to the party. Perhaps the hardest hitting bullet that Jesus throws at them is in verse 24. For I tell you, not one of those men who were invited will enjoy my banquet. Not one of those men who were invited will enjoy my banquet. So these Pharisees, they think they're on the list. Well, they were on the list. But they have put so much value on other things, their stature, other stumbling blocks that get in their way, that they're no longer invited. The host has brought other people in. The house is full, he says. You were supposed to be God's people. You're supposed to lead people towards me. And you know, the Pharisees, they're kind of leaders among the society. But they've got it wrong. And so now the invitation is open to all. It's open to everyone. And with that, Jesus kind of drops the mic and he leaves. And Jesus is out of there. And he moves on to a different crowd. You see, Jesus, he carries on with his journey. It's important for us to kind of remember that at this stage, Jesus is on a journey to Jerusalem. He's got a place to be, a pretty important place to be. He's not like a My Kitchen Rules judge going from house to house, just having meals and meals and meals and meals around the way with no particular rhyme or reason. He's the King of Kings, not the King of Dinner Parties. And so he's on a mission, and his journey is to go to Jerusalem. And he's got something very important to do there. And on his journey, which is kind of always the case, crowds follow Jesus. Heaps and heaps of people follow Jesus. And he teaches them along the way. And along the way, often he would use this time with the crowds and the people to encourage them to follow him. Through lots of different means. He would talk to them and tell them what it's like, what the kingdom of God is like. He would encourage them to follow him, to follow God and to seek him out. And today he does something a little bit different. He uses some different words, and it's the crowd, the people's turn to stand by to get some. All right? And he attacks something that is at the very center of their lives. Let me read verse 25 and 26. Now great crowds were traveling with him. So he turned and he said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Hate. That is just like a strong, dirty word, isn't it, right? Hate. His own father and mother. I love my mum and dad. I'm sure we love our mums and dads. And as a like a 30-something-year-old Aussie blokey male, I've only just gotten to the point where I can actually say that to my dad, right? We've just gotten to this nice point where we can say I love you and it's not weird and it's like, oh, okay, this is something we do now. And so it's a nice, really lovely place to be in. But, you know, and then I'm reading this and Jesus says, hate your father and mother, like, hate them. He says, you know, or MKR, he says, hate your wife and children, you know, you see Belle maybe singing up the front sometimes or playing piano. You probably see that young fella just running around sometimes before or after church. I cannot explain to you in words how much I love these people. And Jesus says, well, if I want to follow him, I have to hate them. Like, it doesn't even make sense, because in the Sermon on the Mount, like, not that a while ago, he said, if you hate someone in your heart, you've committed murder in your heart. Why would Jesus say one thing and then he says something else, right? This doesn't make any sense. What we have to understand about this statement, what he is really driving home at, what he is aiming at, is the role, the deep kind of cultural security and identity that is found in the family of an ancient Israelite. In ancient Israel, for these people, family is everything. Family is what keeps you safe. Family is what keeps you fed. Family is your school, your job, your retirement plan. Family affects the social circles that you kind of move in. Family is every part of your life, and it is the number one priority to be part of, and is the number one priority to care for. That's why in James 1, there's a command to the church to look after orphans and widows. Why would those two particular groups of people be singled out? Well, because orphans and widows, they no longer have that security of the family. Because of their situation, they're now vulnerable. And so that's why in James, the church is commanded that these are particular people we need to look after. Right? They no longer have the security of the family. And as far as identity is concerned, the family was who you are. I am Scott of the tribe of Benjamin, a son of Abraham, right? Like it was where their lineage was. It was what they linked themselves to. It was so important to them. And so for Jesus to say, well, don't find your security and identity in your family. Find your security and identity in me. It's crazy countercultural and risky. And scary, probably. It was a hard prospect to swallow to find their security and identity in Jesus rather than in their family. And stand by to get some, because here comes the artillery. Verse 27. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. It's kind of quite fitting that we read this passage like now at this time where we are in the lead up to Easter, right? We know what this means. This is very clear to us. We're about to celebrate holidays. Our entire nation is going to get days off because of what has happened here. The people here, they don't quite have that full picture that we have, but they do know what it means to carry your cross. That's not a secret to them. The cross, Jesus dying on the cross, crucifixion, it's not a new thing that they invented just for Jesus. It is a well-known style of Roman execution. And so when he says it to the crowd, they will be aware that when he says, carry your cross, He is saying, if you're going to follow me, you need to follow me to the point of death. There's some really, really big words. Now, the beauty is that on this side of the cross, what else do we know? On this side of the cross, we know that Jesus didn't just die there, but he paid the price for mankind's sin. He paid the price for my sin. He paid the price for your sin. He paid the price for all of our sin. He offered his life as a ransom, and he took a punishment that we could not bear. His death wasn't just some kind of pointless martyrdom. Jesus' death on the cross is a sacrifice to God for sin. Now, at this point, the shots have been fired and the smoke's starting to clear, and once that happens, Jesus says to the people who are around him, he offers them and encourages them to consider what he is saying. Right, from verse 28, for which of you wanting to build a tower doesn't first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, after he's laid the foundation and cannot finish it, all the onlookers will begin to make fun of him, saying, this man started to build and he wasn't able to finish. Or what king going to war against another king will not first sit down and decide if he's able with 10,000 to oppose one who comes against him with 20,000? If not, while the other is still far off, he sends a delegation and asks him for terms of peace. In the same way, therefore, every one of you who does not say goodbye to all his possessions cannot be my disciple. Okay. Jesus, worst salesman ever. All right? He's supposed to be encouraging people to follow him. This is what he does on the road. And so the way he goes about it today, follow me. Just leave your status, your land, your possessions, your security, and your life at the door. Let's go. What a great salesman. But I know that in this room, there are a lot of us who would say, we already follow Jesus. I am already following Jesus. I trust him, and I put my faith in him. And so, well, what would it look like for us to put into practice what Jesus is saying? What would it look like for us to prioritize obedience to Jesus over the things that he has talked about? And so I've made a bit of a list of some of the things that Jesus has been talking about, some of the things that he has been targeting with the Pharisees, with the crowd, and even just looking at them, some of them probably ring true with you. But as I look at the list, I think also that some of these peak at certain times in our lives. Some of them are relevant for the entirety of our lives, but some of them peak at certain times in our lives. For example, children, teenagers. The only kind of real currency that they deal in is social currency, is stature, is their standing with their friends. Someone once told me a little while ago they were talking about a trip that their family did around Australia, and they had to pull their kids out of school for a year, and they said, oh, how'd the kids find? And they're like, oh, yeah, they didn't mind missing school, saw lots of great things, they're a bit sad about missing their friends' birthday parties, but that was about it. They were like, that was the only concern of the children on this trip going around Australia, that they missed their friends' birthday parties, right? It's the mind of the kid. They don't want to miss out. And so with our children and this idea of social currency, and these are all just my own ideas. You might have better ideas. You might be looking at this and thinking, oh, Scott, I know exactly how we might have to count the cost in these areas, but I've got some ideas in case you're struggling. Social currency, children. Well, maybe teaching our children, our young children, how to befriend the outcast, right? That kid at school that is a bit of a loner. How do we teach or encourage our children to befriend that person? That might cost them a little bit of social cred, but it's going to mean the world to the outcast and maybe lead to opportunities for people understanding that it's because of Jesus that kid is doing that, even at such a young age. Perhaps with a teenager, you take it a next step, they're able to communicate better, and just helping them to have the courage to share the good news about Jesus with their friends. We can all probably think of someone who is no longer our friend because of the decisions that we made in following Jesus, right? And for a teenager, man, losing a friend, that's a big deal. Like when I was a teenager, that totally would have been a big deal. I'm a massively extroverted person. People are everything to me. To lose a friend, like, oh, man, that would hurt. What about young adults? You might notice I sneaked time in there. Jesus didn't speak a word about time, but he did talk about possessions. And I don't know about you, but I think the greatest possession I have today, like in this kind of day and age, like I guard my time like nothing else, right? My time is mine, and even to the point where, yeah, okay, things might cost a bit extra or whatever. It's my time, okay? Don't take my time. And so I put time up there because I think we treat it like a possession these days. And I think the people who deal most in the currency of time are maybe the young adults. As we go up, they start to gain a little bit of freedom, and they don't necessarily have heaps of stuff. They're not gathering stuff yet, but they've got freedom of time. How can we encourage the young adults in our lives to be faithful with their time, to count the cost with their time? Maybe it's about them being involved in ministry and being in a youth ministry where they give up hours of their weekends and miss Friday night parties or Sunday afternoons with their friends because they're spending time with kids. Maybe it's for them, it's simply just encouraging them and helping them to develop habits to spend more time in their Bibles and praying rather than listening to podcasts or binging whatever show it is so that they can make sure that they're up to date and not miss out or not be able to be involved in the conversations that happen. I don't know. Maybe you've got some better ideas. Moving further down the track is when the possessions, the land, the security, that all kicks in further down the track. Right? We start to put our security and possessions and houses and cars. But what if being obedient to Jesus meant having less? Maybe a less renovated house, maybe having to wait a little bit longer to have the new whiz-bang thing because a friend or a cause or the church needed some money for gospel work to happen. And so we had to put something off to make that happen. Maybe it's just being content with an older car that has nothing wrong with it. It works fine, but we just kind of want a new one. Maybe that's an example. I don't think Jesus here is saying that he wants us to be poor. I don't think that's what he's saying. We live in God's creation, and even though it's broken, we still receive blessing. But I think the question we have to ask ourselves is in our wealth, which kind of I would dare say most of us in this room have, given the country and city that we're living in at the moment, right? With the wealth that we have, how hard are we holding on to these things as our security? How hard do we drive ourselves to obtain them or to obtain more? And how willing am I to part with them? These are the questions that we kind of have to ask ourselves. Well, what about right down the end of the spectrum? As we get towards the end of life, we finish work and we've been working hard all our lives and we hit that wonderful retirement kind of area. And retirement is I've been working hard and whew, now I just get to chill out, all right? I want to tell you a story about a gentleman who I was chatting with at the start of this term. There's a gentleman who's a chaplain at one of the schools who comes down to our campsites. He's a really lovely gentleman named Keith. He's also quite old. I was actually, the conversation I engaged with him, we were having a bet on how old he was, and I engaged with the conversation purely to try and find out how old he was. I did not succeed. He danced around the question very, very well. But I believe he's kind of in his 70s, mid-70s, or almost late 70s. And as we were chatting, I said, well, I wasn't expecting to see you here, Keith. Like, every year, I'm like, oh, is Keith going to be back? Like, he's been around for a long time. And he said, it's funny you say that, Scott. I was supposed to retire 2 years ago. I was like, oh, okay. And he said, well, why are you here? Why are you not retired? And he said, well, I saw a school group from year 7 through to year 12, and that's kind of how I judge, like I reassess at the end of all of those cycles. And I was walking and I was praying, asking God, like, what am I going to do? Where do I go? What would you have me do? And he said he got this really sort of clear thought in his mind. I want you to stay. I want you to keep teaching. And he thought, okay, that's a thought coming along. But then the next day when he got to school, he got there early and he opened up his Bible, which was his habit to read every morning before he started school. And he was currently reading through the Psalms. He was currently in the middle of Psalm 71. And he read these words in Psalm 71. God, you have taught me from my youth and I still proclaim your wonderful works. Even when I am old and gray, God, do not abandon me. Then I will proclaim your power to another generation and your strength to all who are to come. And he said he was deeply convicted by these words in the Psalms. That what was he to do? Teach the next generation. Was the best thing that he can do in his old age, or maybe he's not be capable. He did drop in a line something like, yeah, I'll keep going, but my wife said she's not going to push me in a wheelchair to school. That'll be the time that we have to quit. I was like, oh, good on you. But he is convicted that as long as he is able, he will teach the next generation. And so in our retirement, definitely take a break. I don't think Jesus is saying don't take a break, but in retirement, perhaps what Jesus is saying is don't just start looking after yourself. You have time that you can give to God. And maybe that means that you don't see everything in the world like people often try to do when they retire and bounce around to as many places as they can to see as much as they can. These are just some examples that I've come up with. And some of these examples I might have said, you might think, man, Scott, that'll really hurt. Like, have you actually thought through that? Have you actually put yourself in the same position and think, would you be willing to do that? Trust me, I have. I've been very nervous about getting up and saying these things. This word speaks as much to me as it does to all of us. But last week I was chatting with a member of our congregation about this idea of counting the cost, this idea of sacrifice. And they reminded me of a story in 2 Samuel. I'll give you the gist, but David has been given an order. He's been told to build an altar and sacrifice on it in a certain place because there is a plague coming, and he needs to quickly build an altar and sacrifice in order to avoid the plague. And so he goes to the place, he talks to the person, this person, Aaron. And he goes there, and they have this conversation, and he says, look, David's the king at this stage, by the way. It's very important that you know that he's the king. And he rocks up and he says, I need to do this. I need to build this altar. I need the threshing floor. I need to sacrifice. And the guy says, well, you are the king. It's all yours. You can have it. Right? Have it. Have the threshing floor. Here's some oxen. And what does David say? Well, David says, he says, have it all for free. And David says, no, I insist on buying it from you for a price. For I will not offer to the Lord, my God, burnt offerings that cost me nothing. David understands that sacrifice means cost. Sacrifice means that something must be lost. Right? If we're cruising and we're feeling like, oh, this sacrifice stuff doesn't seem so bad, maybe we're not pushing it hard enough. Because we can probably do that with our wealth like we talked about before. How hard do we push? Because I think if I say to Jesus, oh, these examples I'm thinking, oh, I'm sacrificing and not having a renovated house and my car, that's going to hurt a bit, Jesus. I think the answer he has for me is, yep. Clean, straight, simple. Think about the king in the verses that we saw who surrenders to the oncoming king. He goes out for terms of peace. Those terms of peace aren't, oh, you want peace? Yeah, that's cool. No worries. Off we go in our separate ways. No, it's going to cost the king something. The king is going to have to give something to the other king to keep him at bay. But it's much better than the alternative for the king. All right, now I'm no accountant, but when we're thinking about cost, we don't just think about expense. We also think about income. Right? You ask my wife, I'm definitely not an accountant and money is definitely not my thing. But we talked a lot about expense without thinking about, is there any income? Right? Is there anything actually to be gained out of this situation that Jesus had said to the people and said, you know, the worst salesman pitch ever, leave everything behind and come with me, forget all your possessions. What do the people have to gain? Why would they actually say yes to that? It's because of who Jesus is. It's because of what we gain from following Jesus. We're sitting on this side of the cross, right? We've got so much more information than these people have. What do we have when we follow Jesus? An eternity of citizenship in God's kingdom. A place at the banquet table of God. And when we're feeling the weight of the cost of following, when our loss-averse brains sort of drive us to gain more and say, don't lose, don't lose, don't lose. When all that happens, we need to look forward to the day of the resurrection of the righteous. And in the light of salvation, the things that we have, the time that we spend, the pain that we feel, will pale in comparison to being in the presence of Jesus and welcomed home. We have an invitation to a dinner, to a banquet, paid for by God with his Son. And travelling there might be hard, but Jesus has walked the road before us. And we have the Holy Spirit to lead us. And when we arrive, we are going to see the full measure of how blessed those are who eat bread in the kingdom of God. This week, as you're thinking about, are you willing to count the cost or how you can do that? As you think about, are you able to stand by to get some in those moments where it's going to hurt, in those moments where it's going to be hard? Are we going to be willing and able to stand by to get some for Jesus' sake? Are we going to be willing to make the sacrifice, and are we going to be prepared to count the cost? Because it's a cost and is absolutely worth the reward.